with Custodians of the Planet. Custodians of the Planet brings consciousness to environmental issues and looks at different perspectives regarding the tensions and harmony of human activities in a changing climate. Relationships are complicated and difficult. When it comes to human and nature relationship, it's complex more than ever. Humans find it difficult to comprehend and think deeply about both our impact and our dependence on the natural world. The impacts of this fatal flaw in human cognition are revealed in our unbalanced relationship with the planet. Nature gives us food, clean air, and a home, and in return we create trash, pollution, and ever more humans. The unbalanced relationship is seen in overpopulation, overconsumption, deforestation, and dependency on fossil fuels, to name a few. We also fail to respond to environmental signals such as toxic pollution, mass extinctions, land degradation, and climate disruption. To overcome our monkey brains, we need ideological, behavioral, and political transformation. In other words, given the urgency of environmental problems, we need some sort of an ecological awakening. So today we are here to talk about how to communicate environmental issues with an expert in environmental communication pedagogy, associate professor of environment and society, and the convener of the Master of Environmental Management program of the University of New South Wales, Temma Milstein joins us. Temma's research and teaching focus on the intersections of culture, discourse, and ecological relations. Temma, welcome to Custodians of the Planet.
Thanks, Denise. It's good to be here.
Before you entered academia, you were a journalist. What inspired you to be an academic?
Teaching. While I was a journalist, I ended up teaching a couple journalism courses at the university and really loved that experience. Working with people as they're trying to especially learn how to be a journalist at that point was really exciting. So I felt like this beam of light hit me as I was teaching, and I thought, oh, this is it. This is where I'm supposed to be.
How does communication shape our perceptions of environment?
Interesting. So I'll start with that. It's funny that you mentioned monkey brains because, I mean, I think the monkeys are doing much better than we are.
That's true.
Right? It's really, let's not denigrate other species. We actually are, right? It's our thinking. It's human thinking. And it's not all humans either, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a specific kind of thinking. So you can look at thousands and thousands of years of indigenous thinking that was very sustainable, and communication was very much attached to that, right? And continues to be in many enduring indigenous communities. So in terms of how we think about the ways that communication are related to our ways of thinking environmentally and our ways of behaving environmentally, often in the everyday we think about communication as just a way to reflect a reality that's already out there. Like, oh, I'm just using these abstract symbols to represent something that already exists, and then I'm sending you this message as I talk to you so you know what I'm saying, and then you're sending a message back so I know what you're saying and we're listening, and then we're just kind of exchanging information. But communication is much more than that. Communication is constitutive. It actually constitutes realities. It creates realities. It produces realities. It reproduces realities. It transforms, it resists realities. So the way that I and many other people in my transdisciplinary field think about communication environmentally is it forms our environmental relations. It reflects them, but it also forms them. So it's a social force in our environmental realities. It actually produces them.
The relationship between humans and the environment is shaped around the traditions, religions, culture, political, and economic systems. Do you have any comment on this?
Yeah, and maybe this is a chance to give some examples to what I was just talking about in terms of communication being a social force. Right? So there are many different human nature relations going on right now, right? I mean, this is a vast world with so many cultures, but there is a dominant relationship going on right now. And it has spread through colonization, it's spread through globalization, neoliberal capitalist practices that are transnational and part now of the structural system. So we can go back to the Enlightenment. That's often an interesting place to start, right? And in the Industrial Revolution, this idea that during these times, we in the West specifically shifted a fundamental understanding of human relations with the more than human world. We went from perceiving ourselves as embedded in that world, as part of that world, to a very removed, separate orientation. So our positionality shifted from part of the ecosystem, a working part of it, to, and this again is dominant Western thought, to separate from, different from, better than, master of the more than human world. And that relationship has endured. It's been crystallized through the Industrial Revolution. It's been crystallized through transnational market-based capitalism, right? It's been crystallized through the more than human world now just being kind of either, we could think of it as a backdrop when we say the environment, for instance, that's very much a homogenizing term that classifies the entire more than human world as kind of a, it's kind of there. It's our setting, you know, it's a backdrop. So taking away the diversity, taking away the complexity, taking away the relationships, taking away our own place as part of the environment. And so that's one of the ways that this contemporary dominant mastery relationship manifests. And of course, how else do we talk about things but with the language that we've created that very much has investments. It has investments in reproducing the status quo. And it's not just the language, right? It's the larger power structures that are very invested in continuing to reproduce themselves as they are because of all the people who are involved, right, who are benefiting from that. And those are the people with voice, those are the people with power, those are the people who are influencing power, right, influencing politics.
Moving to the environmental communication, what are the major barriers to effective environmental communication?
Going off my last response, culture is something that has become, it's ingrained, right? It's also this process and this force, and communication is caught up in culture. And it's very difficult to stray from the accepted vernacular that we all share in speaking about ourselves, speaking about environment, speaking about climate. Now, climate is a relatively new thing we're talking about, but so that's a massive barrier, right? Is that there is kind of one way to talk about things. And when you stray from that one way, I'm speaking on an interpersonal scale right now, right? Not institutional or structural, but if you think about our everyday communication with each other, it's very difficult to stray from the status quo when we speak with each other. Partially, it's difficult for people to understand what you're saying if you start saying things differently. Partially, it is a personal challenge to set yourself apart as being different, right? When you start saying more than human world instead of environment, for instance, people are going to kind of stop and try to understand what you're saying. And then if they do understand, they're going to be like, you're different. But they're also going to start to think differently, right? So part of it is it's a personal challenge of, A, can I find different ways of representing and producing environmental realities? And B, can I start to use those in my conversations with others? And not just in the everyday and interpersonal, but in your positions of power, if you're a politician. It's a major step, right, to start to speak differently about reality because it really challenges the status quo deeply. So it's that gaining awareness, I would say, is the first challenge about why does communication matter? Gaining awareness about other ways of speaking and having that be a collective shift. And then doing it in whatever role we have from whatever power place we have, whether it's a student or working in retail or, you know, being a professor or being a politician or working in a non-governmental institution. Wherever we are, how do we bring about change, right? And one way of doing that is starting to represent reality in a very different way from how it has been represented for quite a long time.
Interesting. How would you define the contemporary nature culture?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting time because a lot of us are starting to feel pretty depressed, right? Nihilistic even. And so I think in some ways, it's really about getting in touch with our emotions. You know, it's about realizing that, okay, yeah, I feel pretty deeply concerned. I feel like I'm up against the world sometimes. And starting to shift to, okay, I've now worked through those emotions. I've worked through them with others. You know, because I think one of the things we do is we try to protect ourselves from those emotions because they're really difficult, right? Sure. And in doing so, we can shut down. We can feel like we're powerless. We can feel like it's all over. And it's absolutely not all over, right? We're in a place of visions and we're in a place of massive evolutionary transformation, I think, as a species and probably as ecosystems. So, I mean, we're seeing the destructive aspects, right? But we also are a generative species and a regenerative species. There are so many examples of that from so many indigenous histories and knowledges that endure. So part of the way forward is to start to bring forth these visions of what do we want right now? What do we want right now? Because things like capitalism, that's how that came about. Some guys, a handful of guys, sat together in a room and came up with capitalism, really, right? And then it kind of spread, right? So now we accept it as just the way things should be, that, you know, that life is based on consumption. That's a construction. And so in terms of environmental communication, eco-cultural communication, cultural communication, capitalism is a discursive formation that has material consequences. What is the discursive formation we want to be part of right now? And so it's about envisioning that together. And many people are, right? I mean, we have movements that have been doing that. We have academic intellectual movements. We have political movements. We have the Green New Deal, for instance, in the United States. Right, we have a well-being measurement in New Zealand that just came forth as a new way of measuring success as a nation state, and we have uprisings. Right, we have children uprising all over the world right now with the student strikes for climate. We have Extinction Rebellion of people of all ages and creeds who are rising up, and they're putting forth new ways of communicating about human nature. At the same time, we have indigenous movements and indigenous communities all over the world that are renewing, that are reintroducing very old ways and very enduring ways of communicating about what is it to be human, what is an environment, and environment is not something that's generally used. So it's a remaking through our communication of our present and our future.
And what do you think about the media's performance in delivering environmental news stories?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting times, right? So we're finally seeing some climate coverage, right? We're finally seeing more environmental coverage. I mean, The Guardian, for instance, just started to put out a specific coverage on that. The New York Times has a specific climate desk, right? I mean, but those are some of the better outlets, right? But the stuff that most people are interacting with in the world in terms of media, there's very, very little coverage. I know that in the United States, the ABC News Network, which is one of the three major networks, television networks, there was a study or a report recently, I think it came out last week, and I hope I have the information right, but I believe that the coverage by the ABC in the United States of the royal birth, the recent royal birth in the UK, there was more coverage of the royal birth than in that week or two than there was of climate for an entire year.
No way.
You should check these facts before you put this in there. But this is the US that doesn't really care about royalty, right? Much less so than Australia or the UK, that's for sure. So that's, I think, an example of how completely off balance media coverage is. And this should not be a surprise, right? Because most media, unless it's not profit, unless it's publicly owned, unless it's, right, governmentally funded in a free government, most media is corporate owned. And so it is often it can be part of the problem. unless you're looking at the best news sources, right? Like the ABC in Australia or NPR or PBS in the United States, which still all are going to have constraints on their coverage, you know, low budgets, having to please governments that maybe don't want that kind of coverage to some extent. So there's that. However, I had talked about some bright lights, and there's also this notion of, there's different terms for it, but constructive journalism is one way of thinking about it, or civic journalism, where it's an approach as journalists that you take, or an approach as a journalism outlet that it takes, of what we cover, whether it's climate or social issues, which, by the way, you can see are always interrelated, usually, even if it's not explicit, that when that coverage is done, A, the coverage is there, and B, included in that coverage is context, thorough explanation, and ways forward for readers to take as people who can be part of the solution.
So environmental communication is a critical determinant in the transitions, for example, fossil fuel to renewables, plastic bags to reusable ones. And what about people who are not taking responsibility for being custodians of the planet? What kind of a communicative method would you recommend?
Yeah, I mean, this is a major issue, right? I mean, if we get back to nihilism or denialism or whatever we want to call it, I mean, there's a lot of that, right? We don't consciously want to engage with the mass scale of our impact. And if we get little peaks of it, many of us just want to shut it out and pretend it's not happening because it's overwhelming, right? And there's a lot of anxiety these days. I mean, anxiety I notice in my students at the university that I and my peers did not have in the 80s and 90s, right? And it's not just environmental, it's social media, it's, you know, it's screen addiction, it's feeling disjointed, fragmented, and just separate from our communities, our places. And so that I understand. I mean, people just want to, you know, watch Netflix and not learn how to compost, for instance. But in terms of ways forward, the thing that I do sometimes with my students is we talk about what words aren't in our language right now that might be useful in kind of pointing out problems. So one thing I actually put forth is, okay, what about, we don't have a term for someone who doesn't recycle, right? We don't have a term for...
It's not like tosser, you can't, yeah.
Yeah, that would be a problem here. But I think I'm still learning Australianisms, but yes. But right, I mean, there are different ways of talking about this, but we don't really have that. And labels matter, right? I mean, they could be used for good and for bad. So one thing I've asked my students in the past is come up for a term for, so, you know, and because this is a frustration a lot of them have, is my parents don't recycle, my roommates don't recycle. You know, I just see them creating all this waste and I'm right here with them and I can't have an effect. What can I do? And one term that I thought was brilliant that one student came up with is landfillers. And I mean, not that name calling changes things so much, but when we start to draw attention to what our actions do, it changes things. And so, for instance, in Tasmania, at the MONA, which is the Museum of Old and New Art, amazingly designed place, they have, my memory is, this is what it says on the bins. One bin says landfill. And I've seen that in other places as well. So you have, you know, recycling, and you have compost, and then you have landfill. That act in itself, right, if you have to look at that and instead of something that just says nothing or is it just a rubbish bin, if you have to look at that and say, I'm putting this in a landfill right now. I mean, you can go much farther, right? You can talk about where the plastic ends up. And I have had students in the past do some really interesting eco-culture jams where they are, and the idea with those is that you're playfully and publicly challenging the status quo in an interactive way. So for instance, some students, one term kind of populated all of the rubbish bins around campus and covered them. Actually, what they did is they made the entryways really little. And to get in there, people had to reach through a growing plant. So they made all these hanging plants off the side. And look at these images of midway birds. These are the birds, right, who are so full of plastic that they die. And there's a well-known photographer who's been going through and and capturing these images of these dead animals' bodies full of plastics. So the people had to reach through this kind of living space and a live space and over the kind of consequences of what not recycling, for instance, does. At the same time, the students were there with information and alternatives. So I look actually to my students for this because I feel like every term people are coming up with new creative ways of addressing these kinds of issues. There are lots of studies as well about what might work, you know, appealing to selfishness, not appealing to selfishness, appealing to personal stories tends to work. So you can look up the research as well, and you can see how some campaigns have been based on this research. But I'm in some ways much more interested in what my students freshly come up with each term, because I think it's creatively game-changing.
And also the new generation.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you also lived in the States. And what are the differences between intercultural dimensions of Aussie and US environmental perception you have identified so far?
Yeah, I've only been here 5 months. So I don't know if I could speak just saying this is my answer and I know it's the truth. I can tell you my first impressions, which is there's not a huge amount of difference that I've seen so far. We have the same kind of climate disruption deniers as well, maybe. Maybe not to the same extent as the US, which has gone, you know, kind of into insanity land. But so I think in terms of indigenous protectors that we're seeing in all the Americas, really, and also in Australia, where indigenous communities have been rising up for some time, but more and more are leading the way in terms of being protectors and guardians of the planet, of planetary places as well, locally. So that's an interesting similarity. I'm interested in learning more about how that is. I think one difference here that I've noticed so far is that the Great Barrier Reef is hard to ignore, right? And it's very much part of, it's a symbolic of this country. And so I think it's something that maybe more people are paying attention because of that. Maybe people feel the loss more poignantly because of that. There is, I feel, more focus here on mass extinction.
True, it's a cultural identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And both on land and in water, right? So Australia has been losing so many species because of human actions, specific kinds of human actions, and also because it's a smaller population country. I think in some ways, more things can happen more quickly in smaller population countries. I mean, the US is pretty vast in terms of population, and it takes it's a lot to move that kind of giant population. So it's definitely not definitive. Nothing's definitive, but that's my starting point right now.
And lastly, some of us get depressed thinking about the planet that future generations will have to live on. We talked about this, but let me ask again. What kind of a framework do you envisage for reconsidering and rebuilding our relationship with nature?
Yeah. I mean, for some time, we've been shifting from a mutuality-based approach to life, right? That everyone and everything must thrive in order for us to survive and thrive. Many indigenous knowledges have focused on also multi-generational thriving and ancestral and future generations, multiple future generations, multiple ancestry generations. So that kind of partnership, embeddedness, I am of the land is of me. And my role here is to be a guardian, a custodian, a protector, is where we have come from out of necessity, right? Because we didn't have this mobility, because we didn't have these large structures that we can kind of count on, at least for the short term, because we had to count on the food right there, right? We had to count on the water right there. We had to be part of this place. There's a spirituality that has part of that, belief systems, origin stories that endure because they're deeply meaningful, because they are really good guides, right? And they are truths. There's so many truths. So we have bought in predominantly into a truth that we are consumers, that we are not partners or in a mutual situation, but we are very much separate. That there's a duality, that there's humans and there's everything else. So our shift needs to be from duality to mutuality. And the good news is...
Do you think, is it mutuality or oneness?
Right. Well, it's what speaks to you, right? I mean, mutuality, right? Because you could argue, well, mutuality still means humans are one place, nature is the other. And I don't mean it that way. What I mean by mutuality is not just humans mutual with nature, but everything mutual with each other, everything mutually thriving. So less of a one thing here, one thing there dynamic, and more of a multiplicity of mutuality. And yeah, that's a great question and clarification. The good news is that we have models that are still very much present, right? Traditional ecological knowledge, and in a lot of new ways of going about things that are coming from different places around the world. So it's about a fundamental shift. And it goes back to what I was saying about this notion that we are at a key evolutionary moment. And it's about an evolution of consciousness. And an evolution, some people argue, happens really quickly, right? It could happen over hundreds and thousands of generations, or it can happen instantaneously. So we're at that moment where it has to happen pretty instantaneously. So how are we part of that evolution? And I think that's also a really important thing to remember, is that we're part, we're not the whole, when we're thinking of us as individuals, because it can get very overwhelming when we feel like we've got to carry the world on our back, right? And I think many of us who are dedicated to environment and society work in our lives can feel that way, right? Kind of alone and like, we've got to do it all. But that's not ecological. There's no one doing everything, right? Ecological life, which is what we are, is multi-voiced, right? Multitasked, relational, constantly evolving, constantly in process. So in part, it's also re-envisioning who we are as individuals. We are not these like separate units, and we're not the all-knowing master.
Associate Professor Tema Milstein is the convener of Master of Environmental Management Program of the University of New South Wales. Tema, thanks for coming by.
Thanks.
Custodians of the Planet is an independent and freely available media program, and it relies entirely on contributions from listeners. If you appreciate what we do and would like to support us, there are a few ways to do so. Start a conversation with your friends and colleagues and be part of the change. Share a link to our podcast on social media. Donate to our podcast. Each episode is the product of hours of on-location audio recording, editing, research, scheduling, and music composition. Just $10, a couple of coffees will sustain the hours of labor that go into producing each episode and ensure Custodians of the Planet is an ongoing series. Thank you for your support. For this episode, I would like to say special thanks to Rachel Raymond for editing the scripts, The Madrigal for sharing their music, and Chris Jofores for his technical support. Stay tuned for the next episode!